In 1874, the British government passed a series of laws called the Regulation of Public Worship. A lot of people cared an awful lot about church back then.
True.
On one side, people wanted more ritual and ceremony.
Order.
On the other side, they wanted mostly none.
Yeah.
In the midst of the battle, one minister, a rector in London at a church called St. George in the East, had stopped a practice whereby people who volunteered in church services could avail themselves of liquor from the rector's cupboard before and after the service. The Reverend King closed the cupboard. We have opened it again. Welcome to the rector's cupboard.
Order!
I'm here with Allison Williams.
Hello, Todd.
And Amanda Mina.
Hello, Todd.
It's been a while since we've even been in the office here together.
It's good to see each other again.
Studio. There's been sickness. There's been all of the kinds of things. And Easter.
Yeah, Holy Week hit us. And
yeah.
So many things.
He is risen right in the midst of all of our busyness. So good to be back together. Yeah. So I was at Promise Keepers.
Sorry, when?
What?
I don't know, when was it, like 1994?
Okay, sorry, the way you started that, it sounded like a recent event.
I was a young man, and I mean, they were all men.
Yeah.
And it was in the Kingdom in Seattle, which doesn't exist anymore.
Aww.
And there was this one time, I've talked about it on the mic here before, that you were supposed to stand up and recite the seven promises of a promise. There's a lot of standing up and sitting down
feels liturgical.
But there was one where, like, standing up was like a declaration or whatever. And of course, in these mass settings, kind of everybody's standing up. But I already had, even as a young man, I'm like, this is bristling with me, like, theologically. And kind
Todd
of,
may have a little bit of a defiance streak.
And I didn't.
No kidding.
I didn't want to stand. And it's this huge football stadium, which is like the most sacred of all spaces and that kind of thing. And also, there were a few other young men with me from the church I was there with, and I looked around and I noticed, like, everybody's standing in this place. Like, if I could take just my row and reach all the way around the stadium, I wondered to myself, this is actually possible. Maybe not, but I think it might have been this way, that the only link in this chain of standing people that is broken is, like, me, because I was being asked to stand at this point and you know, and the standing was a declaration that you agree to this or you agree, and I didn't think that way. But
so
then I realized
sitting?
I did. I stayed seated.
You just sat there.
And then I realized I looked down or either my row or maybe just above or just below, and there were like two other younger time people from our church, and they were sitting right beside their dad, who, like, you know, accepted Promise Keepers as his savior and Lord the year before, and they were seated too, and I thought, and he had, like, everything in him, was like, I'm going to bring my boys to this. And I thought, it's just interesting, generationally maybe there was something going on. But I've thought of this because I read this piece by John McWhorter, a really interesting writer, in the New York Times recently, about standing ovations.
Yes.
And you guys read it, I sent it to you. He mentions that at Broadway shows, and that he thinks back to the 80s kind of thing when he was going to Broadway shows. And sometimes you gave a standing ovation.
Yeah.
And sometimes you didn't.
He actually, it goes back to the 60s.
Oh, does he go back to the 60s?
Yeah, it's even further, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's from his recollection or from other people's. But yeah, he cites going back to, like...
And his consternation was what? Or his reason for bringing it up?
Well, first of all, that a standing ovation used to mean something was extraordinary. Not just that it was passable, not just that it was even good.
So how do you mark the extraordinary now? If there's
and that's part of his thing, is
he's
like, where do you go from here? He posits a couple of problematic suggestions.
Oh, yeah, that weird thing, like take your clothes off or something, was really weird where he had that in there and the kind of...
Oh, when he's like, you know, how could you possibly say that something's extraordinary now? How do you express that? Because, you know, what do? You bring out a foamy finger? Like, what's the next step? If you're, if everybody's already standing up and they're cheering and clapping, how do you say it's incredible as opposed to what, you know, just happened? He calls it weird and clumsy because the standing ovation is simply a sign of approval.
Yes, rather than
expressing that.
Have you experienced this at shows and stuff? Where
Oh, of course.
Like, do they all have standing ovations now?
This sounds so, like, highbrow. I have season tickets to Broadway shows.
Yeah.
So
here in Vancouver.
Here in Vancouver. Yes. Yes. I don't.
No, no. She flies out to New York.
It did sound extra.
I know. Broadway across Canada. Yeah, is what it's called. Yeah. But I get to go see a number of shows per year. It's amazing. But there is a standing ovation at the end of every single one of them.
Yeah.
So I get what he's saying.
Well, so now all
it's
you
not
can
even just at
do...
Broadway shows. Like, this sounds. My husband and I have season tickets to the VSO.
I don't have
Vancouver, the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra.
Which are like we have like literally the cheapest tickets possible. Yeah. Like it they end up like $20 a show. It's lovely, but every
show. Does everybody
show,
stand up after that as well?
Yeah, and I mean. It's beautiful music, and there have truly been some extraordinary performances that we've seen.
Well, they've all been extraordinary.
I don't know that all of them have been like almost like.
Have you ever wanted to stay seated?
Yes,
I could admit that I have.
So all that's left is just staying seated a little longer.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, there's a few things that he throws in there that like, and I think this is where he went back to the 60s where. Watching TV on a nightly basis became the norm. And so the way that you take in media, the way that you take in performance has changed.
Right. Right.
And the accessibility of going to a show. So like the average person probably doesn't go to a million Broadway shows.
Right.
Right. Like so
going
to
itself
them,
is exceptional.
Yeah, yeah. It's a night out. It's incredible. And so like, you're not going to be this like, connoisseur of what is or is not actually an extraordinary performance.
You paid so much to go to, I remember him saying in there, you paid so much to go that you want it to be extraordinary. So you kind of,
but although you also, in some way you don't know
you want the opposite.
Maybe it's just the average person who doesn't know.
It is subjective as well.
Yeah.
Like if I go to see one show and I think it's amazing because that's what my experience is, then it's amazing for me. But I don't necessarily have a lot to compare it to. Mm-hmm.
There's a question that, like, if you're looking at this kind of from a sociological perspective, or the feeling of the transcendent or awe that, like, people like Dacher Keltner and others talk about, that one of the things they list is collective effervescence, this feeling of, like, you're in something together and you're in. Mm. So if you were to ask yourself in the moment, like, at a show, concert, whatever, and I don't really think I want to stand right now, but you stand. If you were to ask yourself, why am I standing? Of course, some of the answer would be if you didn't want to stand because you didn't, you may even really liked it, but not enough to get up. And so then if you find yourself standing, you're standing because of what's happening in the room.
Other people are doing it.
Isn't the worst thing in the world. But all of this, of course, relates to, as we talk around concepts of, I think, interestingly, both like for this podcast, for Rector's Cupboard, any gatherings of faith or church, and then anything around like, activism and social justice, and I don't think he uses the word in there, but it's a kind of coercion where you're doing something not because you want to. And again, this is important in our lives. We have to do things at times, but there's a coercion in the room. I better stand up because, and how that translates into the church experience, like just alone that we say, stand if you're able or whatever, or you know, stand up, whether it's a liturgical church or more evangelical church, which has its own liturgy, right? Everybody stand now, everybody sit now, everybody. Like, have you ever been in worship time in church and you're like, I don't want to stand?
Oh yeah, I can admit that.
And there have been times seated? When I have,
I mean, actually, because it would be more worshipful in a sense to stay seated at that moment.
I've been attending a small Anglican parish in North Vancouver recently, and what I have, which is, you know, a bit of a new experience for me coming from an evangelical background, and so some of the format of it is very different. But even and I don't know in my broad Anglican experience, in the experience that I've had at this parish, truly it is invitational, and the community it feels like that. So there have been times where, like, in an Anglican service, there definitely are a lot of times where you stand up, sit down.
Are there
sit
like
up.
Kneeling boards and
there
stuff?
Are yeah. And some people use them, but I have truly experienced in that community that it is invitational, not coercion, because there have been times where, and you see this because Anglican communities, I think at least mostly do communion, Eucharist every week. And so you go up to partake it in an Anglican church. But if people choose to stay, like there truly is no judgment there.
Yep.
And so I certainly, and so I feel like in, as far as like activism is concerned, I think the point of activism is you are hoping that you can inspire people towards what you believe to be a worthy cause. Like that's kind of the point of an activist, is to bring visibility and hopefully to communicate what you see as something that's valuable, and other people hopefully will understand that as well. But so it's got very good intentions, but it can be coercive, right. But it doesn't need to be.
Yeah, I think of it with our guest today, and of course the interview around COP28 and climate change and activism and some things now in the world, like even important issues, where if people feel forced, mm-hmm. how many people, I could put myself at times in this, there's a knee jerk, but not always knee jerk, a thoughtful reaction going like, if I'm forced, then first of all, I've never really, do I think this way? Why do I care? Mm-hmm. How am I most likely to actually become involved in a way that makes a difference? Or is this only being forced? And that doesn't mean that invitation and even like helpful, you know, here, come along type things can really, really help. But it's one thing I love about how our guest today talks about the things that she cares about, because it seems invitational in that kind of way.
Oh, 100%.
And having been at a place like COP28, right, where this is like literally like the place to talk about these things, and even where some argument comes up because it's like, this last time was in Dubai, right?
Yep. Location.
All this stuff. And yet for her to speak about these things in such a way, like I can see how much she cares about that. Mm-hmm. And she's inviting others in to care, but not that coercive, judgmental kind of, it's a fine line to walk. Right. And I think the Broadway show or the concert just shows how often we are in these places where it's like, am I into this right now? Or am I doing this because of these other reasons?
Well, for
which
our
aren't
guest, I mean, if I think about it, it's so relational. Yeah. Like really the things that stuck out to her, you know, the location was extraordinary and where they were and mm-hmm. how she had to travel around the world, but ultimately it was the people that she spent time with.
Yep.
And so much of what she's so passionate about is these relationships.
And seeing how much they cared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, if you're at a Broadway show, you're not entering into a relationship.
What would that mean at a Broadway show, right? To kind of, you know, let's say you enjoyed it. What if you hated something and somebody else loved it? Then there's that. But if you were sitting and somebody beside you loved it, they stand on their feet, they're like just into it, appreciating, so you stay seated, but you're appreciating how much they enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Which is different than your experience.
Well, yeah. And I
think yet you are engaging with that and grateful for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it can come down to almost like an understanding of allowing other people to experience the world as they experience it, and hoping that there's reciprocity, that you are then permitted to experience the world as you experience mm-hmm. it, and that we can come to a place of relationship with each other where we're not looking that the inclusion of other perspectives or other experiences creates something that is just like a homogenous blob, mm-hmm. That it's not erasure, but that it's like additive. Mm-hmm. And like, so there's ways that you can have experiences where, and I know that Deb talks about this in our interview with her about the other activism spaces that she's been exposed to through relationships, but it's always done in that relational way.
That's really good.
And I think that anybody who's engaged in activism understands like there is not the human capacity to care about all issues at all times. Yep. Like that's just not possible. And so I feel like what feels like a responsible way, in my perspective, to view activism is to find where you feel passion towards, but then not to try to force other people to do that. You can have, like, allow people to have their passions, but not judging when other people don't experience that passion the same way.
Yeah.
And I think that that, like, you're talking about a fine line. Well, there's a fine line between having indifference about issues.
So a challenge for us, our challenge for us and our listeners, next time you go to a show.
Don't stand.
Don't stand.
No, no, no.
Can we say that at church too?
I'm not saying don't stand, then that's a coercion of its own. If you love it, stand.
If you don't want to.
Yeah. If you liked it enough to sit and be like, I really like that, then but you don't want to stand, then don't. Maybe even in church. I don't know what church you go to and how you, but if you feel like staying seated for one of those songs and just listening, because it is,
just do it.
Then, yeah. And not, it's interesting. I'm not saying out of some individualistic drive, but the realization that the collective experience doesn't mean you're all feeling the same thing at the same time. And the collective is different parts of the whole, not everybody feeling the same thing. So anyway, it's a great interview. Thank you both for chatting, and we're pleased to present this interview with Deb Walker now, who went all the way to Dubai.
Dubai. Welcome to Rector's Covered. We are very excited to have Deb Walker from Shaughnessy Heights United Church with us today. Before we get to our interview, I want to say hi to my co-host Todd.
Hi.
And hi, Amanda, my co-host. Welcome. So glad to have you here. And Deb, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
I'm going to read our bio about you so our listeners can learn a little bit. And then we are going to talk about COP28, which I'm so excited about this conversation. Thank you so much for coming. Our guest, Deb Walker, has been serving communities as a United Church minister for over 20 years in Western Canada. Currently, she serves as Minister of Connections and Social Justice at Shaughnessy Heights United Church in Vancouver. In her public and private life, Deb is committed to the work of reconciliation between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples, speaking out, showing up, leading events, and seeking to live out the calls to action of the TRC. Through her community involvement, Deb has witnessed the positive impact that harm reduction, poverty reduction, excellent childcare, and community-based healthcare initiatives can have on all of our communities. Deb believes God calls us to be healers, healers and doers of God's word in the world. Deb came to ministry via an honors science degree from the University of Guelph. Her call has always been intricately informed by creation. She was the recipient of the YWCA's Women of Distinction Award for Community Building in 2020 in Saskatoon. And Deb is married to ministry team member Dave Morris, and they have 4 children, 3 grandchildren. And you also serve, Deb, as the president for the Emmanuel College Alumni Association. And what you are here to talk to us mostly about today was a Christian climate observer at COP28 in Dubai. My goodness, Deb, this is quite a life.
You're busy. I'm interested in, came to ministry via an honor science degree from the University of Guelph. That's not a standard path to ministry.
No.
Maybe in the United Church. Lots of my MDiv classmates at VST, their bachelor's degrees very wide.
Yeah, but they weren't like, I want to be a minister, I'll go to the University of Guelph.
But I'm also a scientist.
Do you know what? It was such a fruitful pathway for me. So my dad is a forester. My grandpa was a conservation officer in the Great Lakes. And my childhood was with... living with my grandparents for 17 summers on Georgian Bay. And I think by way of like filling up our day, my grandpa would take us on 4 walks, like morning, noon, afternoon, and night. And so it just created this pattern of, I think, observation and delight and just spending time in creation. So in Ontario we had to go to grade 13 back in the day. So I was like 19 and they did the aptitude test to see what path we should take for university, and mine came back farmer, minister, or biologist. And I'm like, well, I don't have any land, so I'm not going to be a farmer. I sure as hell I'm not going to be a minister.
Amen.
So I guess I'll be a biologist.
Wow. So soon you'll be a farmer is how this soon, works out. Because the other two are checked off.
That is so prophetic. That could happen.
Well, I'm just saying the other two are.
Oh my gosh. And then actually my honest goodness call to ministry was through a electron microscope looking at the mitochondrial structure of a chicken egg, like the nucleus of a chicken.
As one does.
And I distinctly remember everything about that moment on the lab bench and looking in, and you have to like draw and describe things. And I just had this overwhelming feeling of this was not an accident. Like, this is so beautiful. The structure was so designed that I remember thinking to myself, like, oh, there is a God. You know, and so that was the affirmation and the, like, I think that actually was the moment of my, you know, call. Years of call.
That's beautiful.
So. You know what they say about call?
Well, they say, what do they say about call?
It's like throwing up. Sooner or later, you got to do it.
That's true.
I'm not sure that I have heard that.
But I hadn't heard that before.
I'll take it. So
the feeling won't go away is what I'm saying.
Ah, I see. Yes, true. No. I have not heard that specific analogy.
Right, so try as you might. It's going to happen.
It's going to happen, yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that we wanted to talk to you, well, kind of like the biggest one, although I feel like we're continually finding more as we go along here.
Oh, this could be a long and winding conversation.
You recently returned from COP28 in Dubai. And I mean, I don't want to presume that all listeners maybe know what that is. So I would love if you can tell us what COP28 is, how you came to be involved.
Sure.
And why you wanted to be involved.
Sure. So a year ago, there was a large United Church in Vancouver, St. Andrew's Wesley United, gave a big donation to the Sierra Club of BC to kind of explore a curriculum of education. It was called Mother Tree School. It was based on the work of Suzanne Simard at UBC. And their first cohort was faith leaders. And there is this strong impetus towards connecting faith leaders to climate justice. Mm. The church had thought, we've been at this for 30 years, we're not moving the dial. Like, what new thing can we do to make some change in the work of climate justice? So I got to be one of the, I think there was 17 of us, faith leaders from around the Lower Mainland. And there I was exposed to three of the staff people from Arosha, Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Mm. Who just like blew my mind, the work that they do at Arosha, which is a Christian-based environmental community involved in creation care. So I met Samuel, and then in July, Mother Tree School was amazing, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then in July, Samuel just emailed me and said, hey, why didn't you apply to be a Christian observer for COP28? And I was like, what is that? So I did my research. And so it was like a really steep learning curve. And I worried that I was too old or didn't have enough to bring to the experience. And Samuel assured me, no, you know, apply and see what happens. So I was on a short list kind of the end of August. And then in September, I was confirmed as a delegate to COP28. So COP is the Conference of Parties. And it's like the UN framework of the climate change work. And 30 years ago, it used to just be a small group of scientists. And then in the early 90s, they said, look, this is way bigger than us. This has to be everybody. Mm. It has to be, you know, multilateral, global. It has to be multidisciplinary, you know. So that's kind of the growth of COP itself. And then the Christian Climate Observers Program has been around for 23 years. And it comes out of the States. And and it comes from an evangelical tradition, actually. So again, like,
are people like Catherine Hayhoe and others involved there? Or no, do you know that name?
They love Catherine Hayhoe.
Yeah, she's a superstar.
She's superstar.
She's done this connection to faith communities and really been able to reach some people who would otherwise be unreachable.
Again, just the exposure. I didn't know anything about this organization, and they really focus on a college age Christians. And so we started training together online back in October.
When was the conference? When did it take place?
November 29th. Right.
And it's in the news like every day.
Every day. It's huge. Yeah. It's huge.
Yeah.
And I never thought Dubai would be a place that on my
I was wondering that.
Bucket list?
Dubai. And am I reading this right? I mean, I knew it was in Dubai. But is that number right, that it's 85,000?
That's what I saw on their website.
They think almost 90. There might have been 90,000 people.
So this must... Wow. And I know there was also some conversation around this kind of event around climate being held in Dubai.
In Dubai,
which
right,
is largely built in, you know, it's...
It's a petro state.
Yeah.
And terrible human rights, like just abuse of human rights. Only 20% of the population are citizens. Most of the other people are indentured, like laborers, which is like code word for slaves. And then foreign workers to do all the construction, all the hospitality, all kinds of like really difficult working conditions with no legal representation at all.
So you're there.
It was such a twisted up social structure, and then to have the world show up, it was really intense. Because I was traveling with this Christian organization filled with students, we stayed in the craziest location in just this trash hotel. And I had to share a bed.
Oh my goodness.
Are you serious?
Well, I did wonder with that many people descending on one place.
There's no way the Christian organization or Christian Observers Program could afford anything else, because we were mostly students from North America. There was some people from Africa, some people from Peru, Mexico. There was three Canadians, but mostly across the U.S.
So in your role as a Christian climate observer, like, what did that actually entail? Because I'm looking at this, like, 85,000, 90,000 participants, and I'm kind of wondering, like, what does that actually mean? Like, how many people are talking? Are there just, like, multitudes of, like, rooms and lectures going on all at the same time?
All at the same time.
Oh, my goodness.
So... It was like you were showing up at the airport every day. Like, it was this huge campus. And then there was big teleprompters. And you would look at the teleprompters, because the schedule would change. There was online schedules. But you'd look at the teleprompters and you'd kind of decide, do you want to go to UN negotiations? Do you want to go to side events? Do you want to go to pavilions? Like, there was always something going on from like 10 in the morning until 9 at night. The negotiations sometimes went on until midnight. We were a 1 hour, 20 minute commute every morning on a train. Yes, because we were in the outskirts.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering how you get that many people close to one area.
No,
you don't. That's the answer.
An hour and 20 on the train every day, and it was packed. And there was a woman's car at the end of the, it was like the SkyTrain.
Yeah.
No eating, no drinking, and no chewing gum on the train
for an hour and 20.
Then,
as a person who likes to bring their coffee everywhere,
I'm telling you, these cars were scrubbed clean. Like, women would actually sit on the floor, and you know, I rode the subway in Toronto a lot. I would never sit on the floor.
I wouldn't do that in the SkyTrain in Vancouver.
No. There was such tension between the glossy show of this Expo City, which is where the convention was held, and then where we were staying in Dubai. Mm. But we would get to the site every morning, and then there'd be about 40 minutes of lineup and security. So it was an hour and 20.
And then
it's like going to the airport every day for how long, Deb?
For 8 days. Every day for 8 days.
Mm. That's a lot of airport.
Yeah. And then you actually go to the airport after.
And then, but also you are just running around this huge campus the whole time, because there was 197 countries and with pavilions. And our instruction as Christian observers, we had a lot of freedom, and we were encouraged to go to things that had meaning to us. Mm-hmm. You know, go follow the path of something that will encourage you or be important to you. So
then, like, this conference happens annually, mm-hmm. as you're saying, for a number of years. So for this specific one at COP28, was there some like big overarching issues or anything in particular that like piqued your interest that you were like, I need to make sure that I'm hearing what's happening with this?
Right.
Like,
it was the first time it was held in a Muslim country.
Okay.
And the Council of Muslim Elders paid for and facilitated a faith pavilion. And that was a very...
Is that new?
First time ever. And the price tag was enormous. But so there's no guarantee it will happen again. but because I was a Christian observer, I did feel called to be there. Like, I checked in with the faith pavilion every day, and it was amazing conversations, and all of that is on YouTube. Like, and the panel discussions run from 45 to an hour, and they are on YouTube. You can look up Faith Pavilion Cup 28.
Yeah, we'll throw some links in there for listeners who are interested in these conversations.
But for this COP, the phasing out of fossil fuels was the number
so
one.
So interesting in that place. And I know that was
in that place.
The negotiation, that was a huge deal. And the negotiation went past the close of COP officially.
It became so complicated. Yeah. The other thing is just that commitment to the 1.5 degrees Celsius global increase of temperature. And that's kind of, they call that the North Star. Like, that is the focus for all of the work, is to keep that temperature below the 1.5 degrees Celsius increase. This was the first global stocktake since the Paris Accord. That was 8 years since the Paris Accord. And global stocktake, they kept calling it the GST. So I was confused.
As a Canadian,
I was just like, the GST?
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
Global stocktake, which is basically a report card.
I'm a little scared to ask how the report card came out, Deb.
Not great.
Okay, that's not surprising.
Not great. But the commitment is there. And I got to tell you, to be with 90,000 people who are kind of like your people. I mean, of course, there was competing interests. There was lobbyists. Yes. There was a lot of government. But there were so many other observers, not like... Observers are a huge part of UN conference work, and so they represent a whole cross-section of civil society from all over the world. And so I felt almost like I was in the climate Olympics. Like, this must be what it feels like to be an elite athlete, because it is overwhelming to see the nations gathered. It was extremely powerful. You just sit down like in the big spaces, and next thing you'd be talking to a young woman from Jordan who's a climate activist.
Incredible.
Or, you know, I had lunch with some German university students, and they said, where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from Vancouver, you know, British Columbia. And they're like, ugh. Yeah, it was the first time. And they said, that's where the dirty oil comes from. you know.
Oh, just the Canadian.
Yes.
Yes. I'm not from Calgary. I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was my first time as a Canadian traveling overseas to have that, ugh, you know. And it was just like, wow, you know.
I'm thinking of like conferences, gatherings, and the concept of like spiritual high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you go to and kind of that. Oh, from now on, when I get home, you know, or the sense of the camaraderie, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you described it a little bit, or you could describe the other side of it, the spiritual high. But then there's also times when you're honest in these places often where you feel the opposite, where you feel in the midst of all the stuff, you feel some kind of despair or something. What were moments of that for you? Either that kind of like, I mean, you described it a little bit, but this is amazing and I'm really hopeful at the change and this is good, or... this is really not.
If for me, the actual high was listening to young activists from Africa, because it is life and death for them. Yeah. And I mean, it's life and death for all of us, but it's more immediate and they have much less to lose. Like, we still, you know, I still drive a car that I fill up with gas, you know, like I'm not there yet, but as North Americans, we have so much invested in our lifestyle.
Yeah.
But these young, particularly female climate activists are so empowered, and they will say whatever they need to say directly to the oil executives, and they just won't take it anymore.
Yeah. That's so encouraging.
It's thrilling, and to be close to them you can feel the vibration and the pulse of the spirit at work. Yeah, that's what I came home really filled up with. Yeah.
I'm interested in one sense how you you talk about like why you applied to go and those sorts of things. And so clearly this, and you've talked to us about being a biologist or maybe in the future a farmer. like, so clearly this to me, as you're kind of describing this picture of your life and I'm reading your bio here, like this makes sense to me that you would be here. Like how does this sort of conference and these conversations, like how do you connect that with like the rest of your life? Like you're a minister, but you're also, you know, a parent, a grandparent, you're connected with a community, you live in a very affluent part of Vancouver. Like there's a lot of things, and I'm wondering how this conference and how your experiences from this kind of both feed into the rest of your life and are fed by the rest of your life.
Yeah. I didn't have the language to articulate this beforehand, but I would say now for certain, climate change is the mother of all social injustice and the intersectionality of the climate change to all the other issues that I deal with on a daily basis.
Can you unpack that a little bit?
The reconciliation, like, so how do we leverage and respect Indigenous knowledge about climate and land knowledge and recovering ways of land management that have existed for eons? You know, how do we reclaim those sensibilities? Because there absolutely are enough resources in the world to feed the planet. But how do we reclaim that? And then I think about conflict, poverty, food security, like all of that ultimately goes back to land use and land abuse and the runaway train that is Western capitalism. So those are hard conversations to have in affluent places.
Well, that's how I'm wondering, like, and I'm going back to that model of like, so now I go from like a religious conference of some kind to a mission trip. Remember the old missions trips?
Yeah.
And you get these young people going and, you know,
building houses
in Mexico or running VBS or something. Mm-hmm. Right? And they're 15 years old or 18 years old. And I'll say mostly not most of them, but some come home and feel upset, positively so in some ways, but can get a bit judgy all the time or can even wrestle with it themselves. Like, and I picture you're in Kitsilano, you come back, right? And you must have some of that where you're just walking around, driving around, whatever, just going like, oh, these people.
They have everything. Yeah. Place. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you hold that? Because we've talked about this before, that with this kind of thing, climate change, hope makes a bigger difference than you know, the negative stuff. How do you wrestle with that?
The climate grief and despair is real. And I think the only cure is more love, more reverence, more respect, more care. You know, so you just double down on your relationship, your own personal relationship with creation. And we've done some really interesting work in that Mother Tree School that I spoke of, and it was a lot of indigenous teachings, half indigenous, half settler teaching. Half of it was online, half of it was like out in the woods. And then Suzanne Smart has these deep metaphors of old growth forests being connected and speaking to each other. And sidebar, Ted Lasso. Yep. You guys watched Ted Lasso? Coach, in one of the episodes, was reading Suzanne Smart's book, which was called What the Mother Tree Has to Teach Us. So he was in the office with his feet up on the table, on the desk, and he was reading her book. And so she's got a lot of feedback from industry, like forest industry, saying, oh, there's no way to prove that science, and there's no this and there's no that. And I'm like, since when did industry care about science? You know, but all of a sudden they want to critique.
They're critiquing kind of the network. Like, wasn't there a book called The Secret Life of Trees or something?
Yeah.
It's about this, like how
the mycelium,
everything is connected. Oh,
yeah. And it so sounds a bit Star Trek-y. But, and I had an opportunity to speak to Suzanne, and I just said, whether it is true or not, it is the truth I need to hear. Like, I need to believe in this deep meta narrative that everything is connected. Hmm. And that once we start caring about one thing, you know, once we start treating that one thing with care and love and respect, then it is going to carry
the
through.
Ripples, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, from a biblical framework, you know, we are driven by these big meta narratives,
yes,
of exile and homecoming and restoration and freedom, and so when she's describing the way this old growth forest relates to itself, I'm just like, of course we need that in our lives. Of course we need that story. So we also in Mother Tree School talked a lot about our other than human relations.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's a more indigenous way of looking at ourselves in creation. And so what is the other than human that you encounter? What gifts do they bring? You know, how can you support them, and how can you be reciprocal? You know, and so those are little tiny things about our own lives. But then I'm just thinking, if we create generations of people who are skilled at that kind of observation and that way of living and knowing, you know, I see tremendous hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I think that's beautiful. I think it also speaks to the fact that, I mean, I don't think it takes too much life experience to understand that not everything that is true can actually be empirically proven.
Right.
And that things like myth, I don't mean that in like a derogatory sense, but like story, that there is truth that transcends scientific fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I am so encouraged by how much hope you are finding, because I struggle when I think of the climate crisis to not just sink into despair.
Mm-hmm.
And to feel like we are too far gone. There is too much damage. There is too much vested interest that is siloed in places of power that I don't see as willing to cede what would need to happen in order to create some of these equity systems. But I mean, I am so clinging to your hope, and I'm so grateful for, like, because you're not talking about this from a naive mm-mm. perspective, like, oh, we'll just be fine, everything will be okay. Like, there is relationship and like time and knowledge that you're tapping into, and yet you still find hope. Yeah. And I find that brilliant. Do you feel like the more that you know, the more hope you get, or
the more I discover on this learning path, the more people I meet who encourage me. And so I think it is that empowerment of community. Like, you have to have community to do this. You cannot do this alone. And so I have been placed in this position where I've been exposed to so many incredible people. And that itself is, like, you know, feeding the hope. There's a group now that I join, and it's called Climate Intercessors. And it's honestly people from 24 time zones, and they meet one day a month, but in four different meetings, obviously, to try to catch everybody being awake. And, you know, the group I meet is Australia, the U.S., Canada, you know, the other side of the Pacific. Mm. And someone leads, and they do like headline prayers. And so again, it's always very deliberately based in reality and saying, oh, what about this? And like, let's pray. And that is brand new for me.
Is this something that like anybody could join?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Part of one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is, like, even when we're talking about like the scope of COP mm-hmm. and stuff like that, like, it is really easy to get lost in how big things are.
Right.
And I think that can really easily be discouraging, or people can feel like you can get almost like an apathy because it all just feels too mm-hmm. big. But I mean, you've named a couple of things. So it's Climate Intercessors. Is this Mother Tree school? Is that something that people could try to register in or join, or?
I don't know how the funding has rolled out, but the first cohort was faith leaders. The second cohort were youth and young adult justice warriors, which was incredibly exciting. Mm. And then the third was Indigenous families. And so our goal now is for those three cohorts to come together and do work, but we haven't yet.
Mm-hmm.
So that was through Sierra Club BC. And again, even just working alongside with those folks, just the intersectionality of it, because then, you know, I went on the memorial walk on February 14th for murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls, and all these folks from the Sierra Club were there. Mm. And I'm just like, hey! And so all of this kind of shared energy and spirit. I went out to Arosha for an art and prayer retreat last week. And again, just like, just placing yourselves in locations mm-hmm. where you are just assured that there is goodness and hope, and people are doing the work, and we are not alone. Like, it just, again, it's just like so filling.
So I would Like, I think it's part of that conversation. One of the things that comes up so often, whether you're watching the news or I think it comes up in faith settings too. And I'm interested in the connection with youth and how important that kind of demographic is. And I think I'm thinking of that because who has hope around this and who in the news, there's often this, like, people even say it's too late now.
Right.
Like, it's what kind of difference can be made now if we don't meet some of these targets soon, or actually it's too late. It's kind of, how do you deal with that kind of doom? Because you don't seem like that kind of person to me at all. Mm-mm. Right. You're very inviting in terms of, I think people would be interested in some of these things simply because how you talk about them.
Right.
And that's a different sense than nothing we can do. It's how do you navigate that kind of something better than a doom story?
Right. I guess because the youth that I know in my own life and the young adults I traveled to Dubai with, they already recognize how different the world is and how different their choices are. And they don't automatically think about, I'm going to own a car, I'm going to own a house.
Things that were kind of just presumptions in previous generations.
And in terms of their employment, you know, they don't even think, I need a full-time job so I can pay my mortgage. They are following their passions. They are living with this sense of enough. And I don't see that as a lack of ambition. I see that as a living a really great quality life, having deep, meaningful relationships, deep purpose. And also that idea of celebrating your life, like enjoying your life, you know, and I honestly, I was not raised that way. I was raised with like there is
scarcity, fear, you better get
benchmarks, you know, and so I just am in awe and astonished at their positivity, and a lot of people at COP, say my age and older, were like, oh well, the young people are going to fix everything, they're going to create technology and fix everything, and then the younger people were like, it's your damn mess, not ours. Like, you fix what you've done and we will create a life moving forward. But no, your mess is not ours to fix. So that was a really clear separation in terms of strategies for moving forward. But yeah, I see the young, especially I have to shout out to my young evangelical travel companions, because the cost for them to go home and share this message is way more than my cost to come home to Shaughnessy, you know.
You're preaching to the choir.
I am. Mm-hmm. And so we stayed in contact. We have a big WhatsApp community. Do you know,
so where are they going back to? Like various parts of the world, or were they?
Their colleges and their church communities and their families. And some of them come from like
Southern United States or something.
Yes, and have been raised in quite conservative. And so our big conversation in December was how hard it was to go home. You know how hard it was to take those.
They're not sitting with a bunch of like-minded people.
No.
Yeah.
No. And it is that euphoria of all being together and then going home.
Gotta go back to reality.
Yeah.
You've given me a book title now too. My Evangelical Travel Companion.
So good.
You know what? I fell in love. I fell in love. And there was like some really important, I'd say cultural, spiritual, generational exchanges, and we would have a morning devotional every morning before we left our hotel, and you know, this hour and 20 on the train, there was so much opportunity to really get to know each other.
You had mentioned that Christian observers, faith leaders have been doing this for over 20 years
23 years.
So do you feel like you're now part of this like incredible network?
yeah,
of people that have experienced it before you mm-hmm. will continue to experience it in coming
yep.
COP events. Like, yeah. are you in touch with this like worldwide larger network yes. of these yeah. people that
and some of them shared... are lifers. Some yeah. of them are lifers. Some of them go back every really? Single year. Yeah.
Really?
I don't see myself right. Supporting the work that way, but I've already got a young adult from our congregation who I think will be going to COP 29.
Which it was where?
Supposed to be in Ukraine, but that's not oh. happening. And I'm glad you're sitting down because the next one is in Azerbaijan. Yes. Which is actually worse than Dubai in yeah. terms of location because it is a petro state yeah. with ties to Russia.
Still under yeah. the sphere of...
Yeah. yeah. So that is where the next... Now, part of me thinks, you know, when you do social justice work, it's like, don't talk about us without us. So then I think, well, maybe, you know, us as, you know, climate justice, obsessive compulsive warriors, we need to be in that space and we're invited to that space. And so it's like, don't talk about us without us. We're going to make ourselves
yeah.
present. We're taking up space. We're holding space. And that's what we were taught when we were training for COP 28 too. Like, we're going there to hold space, to pray,
yeah,
to pray for people that we listen to pray for people we disagree with, and not waste our time trying to convince them to think differently.
Well, I wonder about some of this tension. I mean, I would imagine this applies to many different kind of facets of social justice work, climate change being one of them, is you have the tension of... You need to bring certain people that you disagree with on side with you before you're actually going to make significant change. So whether mm-hmm. that be in terms of politicians or company executives or those sorts of things, that if you don't have those conversations, you're just in echo chambers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So things started to slide. There's 2 weeks of COP. I was there for week one. A whole other group of observers came for week two. And we had 2 days together in the middle, which was like so dynamic and fantastic. But so the second week, that's when things really started to slide because the global stock take and the final negotiation was coming. So OPEC showed up with the head of OPEC, their president showed up, and he was holding an information session. And three of the young Christian climate observers got into that meeting where the OPEC president, and basically a letter had been leaked where he had written to the other OPEC countries saying, do not jeopardize our prosperity. So I'm just like... Because they need more money. But that was the language. The
theme of the benefit of people who may not necessarily know what OPEC is,
OPEC is the oil producing nations. Yeah. Like, it's from the 70s.
Yeah.
And Canada is actually an associate member. We're not on the official OPEC team, but we are associated.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we are. So these three young people started challenging the president of OPEC, and they got kicked out. They got kicked out of the meeting, and then the OPEC PR people pulled the president out, and he hoofed it away. And then they kept trying to ask questions. They were only asking questions.
Yeah,
you know, they weren't being disrespectful or rude, but they got pulled out of that meeting. And so they were able to write newsletters about their experience. And right in April, there is a plastic treaty. 172 countries are in negotiations about this plastic treaty. The second to last negotiation in April is happening in Ottawa.
Really?
Yeah. And there are active... enterprises working against the treaty because it is petroleum based, and people, countries,
do not jeopardize our prosperity.
Which
there's no way to talk about climate change unless we're willing to jeopardize our
prosperity. And then again and again, our siblings from the church in Africa just say, you can no longer be a Christian leader and not a climate justice warrior. You cannot separate those anymore. And that's what I found so powerful. And that's really what I came home with, is that I no longer can be kind of tender or hesitant or apologetic about this being part of our Christian call today in the world, to say we have to redistribute the wealth of creation. The gifts of creation are enough for everyone, and that's our work. That's our work. Yeah,
it's wonderful. I mean, I feel like this is one of 50 million conversations that
this could keep going.
You know, Christian communities and organizations need to be having. I'm so grateful that you're coming and talking to us, and that you are actively involved in this work, and that you are putting, you know, your time and your resources and those sorts of things into that, and giving a really beautiful example to people. So first of all, I'm so grateful for that. Thank you very much. I feel like you've probably answered our, you know, ultimate question, but I want to give you another opportunity in case there's anything else you'd like to be throwing in. So we'll end with like our classic final question, which is like, where are you finding hope right now? And it doesn't have to be necessarily in the realm of COP28 or that sort of thing. But yes, I'd like to give you an opportunity to just have the final word here.
So I think I am absolutely fed by the connections and the community. The opportunities to have significant conversations, you know, with all levels of government and policy, and for us to make, you know, we always talk about evidence-based policy, but I think we need to make policy in the spirit of a generous future for all, and it's that we're called to abundant life, right? And so if we take that seriously. And you know, I'm not a communist or socialist even, but what does abundant life for all actually mean? You know, how much is enough? And those huge polarities of have and have not, I think, which are so evident in Vancouver. So how do we moderate that? You know, how do we find that middle path, and how do we be that middle church, you know? So that I think is all doable. And
fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, again, thank you so much, Deb, for also like coming out. It is lovely to be able to talk to people in person. I know it's not possible for actually a lot of our guests, but I'm so grateful that you took the time to come over.
Yeah, and your energy and I'll use the word optimism, like hope. I hear it also connected to call and faith. Is something that is just so much more compelling than, and it's not like you shy away from the reality in speaking with us, but you feel energized in listening to you about these things. And so I'm really grateful that you and others who are able to have that same kind of voice, not that everybody has to have that voice, but that you are able to have that voice in these conversations, because I know it continues to go places. So thank you for sharing it with
you
us.
You are so welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Rector's Cupboard is a production of Reflector Project and is hosted and produced by Todd Weeb, Allison Williams, and Amanda Mina. Our cupboard master is Ken Bell. Rector's Cupboard is made possible by the generous support of donors. Check out rectorscupboard.ca for past episodes, events, and how you can help fund the podcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, which helps other people find us. Thanks for listening.